Is that in a couple of weeks, we're going to be going to Kansas City, so you won't have to listen to me three times every Sunday until the Hamiltons get back. We are back in the book of Esther for this portion of our assembly together. And when I started this series, it worked out really well because I would do a more textual kind of Bible class feel sort of lesson on a chapter of the book one Sunday evening and come back the following Sunday morning and do a more exhortational sort of sermon sort of lesson out of the book of Esther after that. Well, now I feel like I just got done doing one Bible class and I'm starting into another Bible class. So you'll have to bear with that if that seems odd to you. You'll bear with that for just a couple of these as we get through the rest of the book of Esther. But we're in chapter 8 today, and we'll be working our way through that, presuming there is time, and I've not really thought about how the time is going to work out with all of this. But this is the class where we've taken time for comments at the end of what I've prepared to say, and so we'll plan on doing that as well and not let it get too long. I know we've been together for a long period of time. That's the other difference. Is it's one thing to sit for 45 minutes and then chat about what we've talked about for a while. It's another thing to have been sitting for 2.5 hours and then start chatting about what I've had to say. But we'll plan on doing that as well today as we work our way through this. Esther chapter 8. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again with the king. She fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan of Haman the Agagite and the plot which he had devised against the Jews. When the king held out the golden scepter to Esther, Esther rose and stood before the king. And she said, "If it please the king, and if I found favor in his sight, and if the thing seems right before the king, and if I'm pleasing in his eyes, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the provinces of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming to my people? Or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred?" Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they've hanged him on the gallows because he intended to lay hands on the Jews. But you may write as you please with regard to the Jews in the name of the king and seal it with the king's ring, for an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked." All right, we'll stop there here at the outset to work our way through some of what's going on. Now, as you remember, what we have up to this point in the story of the book of Esther is this conflict between Haman and Mordecai primarily, which leads to a conflict between Haman and the entire Jewish race. He has written this edict to destroy all of the Jews on one day out in the future. And it's led to this conflict then between Esther and Haman, where she has kind of pampered him and got him thinking that he was somebody special, only to ultimately out him as the person who is trying to kill not only the Jews, but her, a Jew among them, who the king did not know was a Jew up to this point. And that's where we left off last time with Esther's identification of Haman as the enemy, and then ultimately the execution of Haman. And on that day, we are told, the king gave Esther Haman's house. Now, this is not just the structure in which he lived, but his household, all of his assets, I think, is the basic idea here. His estate, we might say. But notice also what we left off with in chapter 7. And this is going to be something of a problem that Esther's going to have to deal with now. It's not the gift of Haman's estate. I'm actually getting ahead of myself there. But the very last sentence of chapter 7, "Then the wrath of the king abated." And this is, I think, part of the story of Esther that we miss sometimes, not that sentence, but really everything after that sentence. Because we tend to treat the book of Esther sometimes the way the king treated the story of Esther as well. And that is that after Esther has identified Haman and Haman dies, that's kind of the end, we think, sometimes. This is one of those things that's just fascinating to me when I get to teach this book over at the college, is how many of the students will at some point say, I never realized how much happened after that scene in Esther chapter 7. And we just kind of think that's the end. This is the dramatic, climactic moment. Esther has survived, because we make the whole story about whether or not Esther's going to live when she goes and sees the king. She's lived. She's identified Haman. The enemy's dead. Problem solved. No, the problem's not solved. There is still an edict that says all the Jews are going to die. That's the real problem. Not whether or not Haman's alive. Now, that's a nice bonus that he's out of the picture now, too. But the problem of the edict still stands. And you see the problem with the king as well. And we've talked about this king and all the problems with this king, really ad nauseum. But again, to remind you, the man can't make a decision for himself. He's constantly being told what to do by everyone else. The only thing that really seemed to get him angry about this was not that Haman plotted to annihilate an entire race of people, but that he had been dishonored himself. Typical male egotism is what it amounts to. You're dishonoring me, you're dishonoring my woman, you're trying to attack my woman in my palace, I'll show you. And Haman is killed, and he's fine now. Well, wait a second. The thing that Esther was actually concerned about hasn't been solved. That's the problem. And you see this really as it continues on as well. You remember, as we were just reading a second ago, Esther comes and falls before him again and pleads on behalf of the life of her people. And his response is, well, I gave you Haman's house and I killed Haman. And now he's going to eventually say, well, you can also write whatever you want to write. But his initial reaction seems to be, haven't I done enough? Oh, I guess if you want more, you can do more, but I really think I solved this problem by killing the guy and giving you his estate, seems to be his perspective. And you get, again, something of a picture of his cluelessness here. And there's more of the irony that runs through all of this. Of course, Haman's injured pride had led to his desire to destroy Mordecai, and Ahasuerus's injured pride drives him to execute Haman. And now he's completely satisfied, even though he really hasn't done anything about what the real problem is as well. Well, the chapter 8 then itself begins with Mordecai's promotion. Esther is given Haman's estate. She is the one who he intended to harm. So then perhaps that's why she received what the king confiscates from him. And so the money that was once earmarked for the destruction of the Jews, whatever of it that was his that he was going to contribute himself, is now given to the Jews, or to at least a Jew, along with everything else that Haman possessed. And Esther then will delegate this out. She will set Mordecai over Haman's estate. But she also then identifies Mordecai as her relative, and he is promoted. He's given the position that has been vacated by Haman, basically, is what it amounts to. And this is, you know, another striking thing as you think back about the larger context of the book of Esther. Remember, the big secret is don't reveal your identity. Hide your Jewishness. Don't let anybody know that we're related to each other. And I don't know what was going through Mordecai's mind. Again, this is one of the really fascinating things about Mordecai, is you don't get his insights. You really wish you knew what he was thinking. And the more you want to know what he's thinking, the less the narrator tells you about it. Why is it that he thinks this? We don't know. Maybe there's some real danger. Maybe it's a perceived danger. Who knows what it is? But there's this fear over her revealing her identity and the revelation of their relationship. Well, finally, all of this has happened. Her identity is revealed. Her Jewishness is revealed. And what that leads to is the destruction of the enemy. No problem at all whatsoever with the king or with the politics. And their relationship is revealed. And what that leads to is his promotion. And you have to almost wonder, again, especially if you're not looking at these characters through rose-tinted Bible hero lenses, where everything they do is completely right all the time, you have to wonder if they had just been open about their Jewishness at the beginning, if any of this would have ever happened to begin with. You know, maybe she reveals that she's a Jew, like Daniel and his friends did when they're in a foreign court. And she reveals that this official of some kind, Mordecai, who was at the king's gate, is her relative. Maybe he gets promoted to Haman's place on day one, and none of this happens to begin with. And of course, we can't know this, and this is just speculation one way or the other. But it is striking that the very sorts of things that they were so terrified about at the beginning, or if they're not terrified, at least there's specific instructions not to do. When it finally happens, there's nothing but good things that happen as a result of it. Now, we've already talked about some how their relationships seem to have changed from her always obeying him to him being her general, so to speak, at the end of chapter 4, where he obeys her and what she orders and carries out her wishes as queen. Now, there's a further development of their relationship here as well, where she is a source and agent of his wealth and empowerment. And in appointing him over Haman's estate, making him makes him her property manager, you might say, her steward, or the steward of her estate, you might say. It doesn't say that. You know, she gave the estate to Mordecai. She appoints him over her estate, is what she does. And so again, there's kind of another nuanced change in their relationship, and of course, there's also a change in his relationship with Haman, you might say, as he is now overseeing the house of Haman, and maybe his body's still hanging around outside as well. Maybe that's his first order of business, is to get the carcass down. Well, whatever the case may be, there is some change in their relationship. What's more significant than that is what happens as the story continues. Again, starting with Esther's request, she goes back to the king and pleads with him. And we're going to find out that this is actually a few months later when the edict is finally written. This is when I need to have notes that tell me where things are. There's a date given here in chapter 8 of when this edict was written. There it is, verse 12. The 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Nope, that's the day of the destruction. Verse 9. Thank you. The king's scribes were summoned at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. Well, the first edict was written back in the first month, right before Passover. And apparently, this fast that was prescribed was superseding Passover, that they were fasting instead of sharing in the Passover feast itself there. Now, all of this happens in just a few days. Now, there's a question of where do we plug in the missing days? Was it a few months before Mordecai finds out and the fast doesn't actually happen over Passover? It's one possibility. Or I think what may be more likely than that is Mordecai finds out immediately, the fast happens immediately, these series of feasts happen immediately, and then 3 months later, Esther realizes the king still isn't doing anything about the real problem, and she comes back to the king again at that point. I think that's a more natural reading of filling in that missing time, is she is going back to the king to plead with him because she realizes this time has passed and nothing is going on to solve the problem. And so she goes and she pleads with the king. And notice, if this pleases the king, verse 5, and if I found favor in his sight, and if it seems right to the king, and if I'm pleasing in his eyes. She's kind of sandwiching the appeal, is this the right thing to do? Do you think this is the right thing to do? She's sandwiching that between whether she is pleasing in his eyes. And that's a significant thing in the larger context of the book of Esther. Because everything you ever hear about her in other people's eyes is that she is pleasing in their eyes. She finds favor in their eyes. She's appealing in their eyes. Everywhere you find that phrase in Esther, it's positive between her and somebody else's eyes. And so this is something that she can take hold of pretty confidently. And I don't think the point here is that she's not sure whether she's pleasing in his eyes, but she knows that she is, and she says it in this way to soften it, but she is making her appeal on the basis of the one thing that she has confidence in, which is she's going to be pleasing in his eyes. And she's reminding him of that as she makes this appeal, is what it all boils down to then here. Now, again, notice that there's no appeal to right or wrong, really. If it seems right to the king, it has nothing to do with moral righteousness. And there's no appeal to justice or injustice, because these are things that don't really register with him. The word for right there in verse 5 really has more to do with advantageousness. Is this in the king's interest is really the appeal there. But of course, if the king had any moral problems with genocide, he wouldn't have signed the first edict to begin with. He wouldn't have let that happen. And so she doesn't appeal to that, because there's no point in appealing to that. She appeals to, is this advantageous to you as the king, and will you do this for me because I'm pleasing in your eyes, is what it amounts to. And it's a shrewd approach. It's the right kind of approach to make to a king like this, to actually try to get something done. And there may be something subtle about her referring to the law that had been signed as the letters devised by Haman the Agagite. She may be remembering the fact that the laws of the Medes and Persians can't be revoked, and so by not referring to them as laws, by referring to them as something different from that, on the one hand, it kind of avoids his role in the matter, because it was his signet that signed it. He was aware of what was going on, even if he didn't know who it was about. But it's also shifting the focus of the permanence of the laws to their illegitimacy, you might say, in a way of trying to get them taken away. Well, again, his response really seems like, you know, he thinks he's done enough already. What more could I possibly do? I've already given you money. I've already killed your enemy. What more could you want? But you can do this anyway. And here the you is plural in verse 8. Of course, that doesn't translate into English very well, but the you is plural. He's speaking to Mordecai and Esther in this context. He gives them the prerogative to find a way out of their legal dilemma. He reminds them that the Persian law is unalterable, which may refer back to the first one that was written, or to whatever they write, or maybe a little bit of both. But there is that reminder as well. But basically what he's saying is, do whatever you can to satisfy yourself. He kind of gives her a blank check and his signature, which again speaks to just the absurdity of this king. He just got rid of a prime minister that wrote whatever he wanted to write and the king's signature on it. And his solution to this problem is do the same thing for the next guy that comes along. He's not really learning. It's going to work out great for the Jews. It's going to save the Jewish people. But as far as good leadership goes, not so much. You'd think he would have learned something from the first instance of this, but instead he just repeats the procedure exactly the same way. So, verse 9 then, to continue reading, the king's scribes were summoned at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, the 23rd day, and an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded concerning the Jews, to the satraps and the governors, the officials of the royal of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to each province in its own script, and to each people in its own language, and also to the Jews in their script and in their language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring. Then he sent the letters by mounted couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud, saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods on one day throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. A copy of what was written was to be issued as a decree in every province, being publicly displayed to all peoples, and the Jews were to be ready on that day to take vengeance on their enemies. So the couriers, mounted on their swift horses that were used in the king's service, rode out hurriedly, urged by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. All right. Now this is where it starts to get a little interesting, in the proclamation itself. As you look at this proclamation, if you were to look back at chapter 3, verses 12 and following, what you'll find is that they read almost identically. There are some differences here and there, but basically, they're pretty close to word for word, and in some places they are word for word identical with one another. Of course, again, the king is again being perfectly happy to let an edict be written that he has no idea what it says, which is kind of legalizing civil war between the Jews and everybody else in the empire who wants to fight with the Jews. But be that as it may, what is clearly going on is Mordecai is writing an edict, or Esther and Mordecai are writing an edict that is trying to line by line undo what the first edict was. The reason you write an edict almost word for word as the first one and switch out the enemies of the Jews to their enemies, is it's a reversal measure. Now that's a significant point because there are questions that are raised here along the lines. In particular, there is the question of plunder. They are allowed to plunder their goods. Yet what we will find in chapter 9 is that three times in chapter 9 we are specifically told they did not take any plunder. Now, why are they told specifically they can take plunder and then specifically we're told repeatedly that they didn't take plunder? Well, it's because the edict didn't have anything to do with taking plunder. The edict was reversing the original edict. That's what was going on with the second edict. It was to reverse the edict, not to tell them to go take a bunch of plunder. And that's a significant point because there's one other phrase that really gets people worked up about this second edict, and that is the phrase, women and children. Now, what is going on here with this phrase, women and children? Well, one way of trying to solve the issue is to take the women and children and make it the women and children of the Jews. And some translations do this. And I don't know if any of you happen to be reading from one that does this or not, but basically it will say something like, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them and their women and children, basically. If they attack you and your women and children, then you can attack them back, you can fight them and defend them. But it's really more ambiguous than that, and it seems to actually be saying that you can attack them and their women and children. And again, that raises a huge problem because at least skeptics of the Bible are going to really latch onto this and say, what an awful, awful edict this is, and terrible, terrible Jewish people and what they're doing and how awful Esther and Mordecai are. They're going to go killing these women and children. Well, again, the purpose of this edict is not to tell them to go do all of these things specifically, but to undo the first edict. And if something as menial as plundering the people isn't done, perhaps in the interest of what is actually a just sort of thing to do, then how much less do you think something like killing their women and children who are non-combatants would not be done as well? But that was part of the original edict, and so that had to be written out of the original edict, so to speak, by having a specific reversal line in the second edict. And so as you compare the two edicts, I think that becomes a very helpful way of seeing what's going on in some of those more questionable ethical sorts of issues like that. Now, chapter 9, again, clarifies that they killed men. It doesn't say anything about them killing women and children. And chapter 9 also clarifies that they don't take any plunder. But basically what's going on here, more than anything, is they are publicizing the fact that there is a shift in royal backing. No longer does the Persian government support Haman's plan. And this is an issue now where what they are being told, yeah, the law still stands, technically speaking. And if you want to follow that law, you can still follow that law. But know that if you follow the first law, the government of Persia no longer stands behind you. The government of Persia stands behind this second law now. And if you are going to fight against the Jews, and you are ultimately going to be fighting against the king as well, is what it boils down to. At least from a publicity sort of perspective. Now, again, in chapter 9, what you find out is the Jews do their own fighting, but the government stands behind. The decree is saying, you know, yeah, there's a scheduled civil war that's going to be happening in the nation of Persia between the Jews and whoever wants to fight the Jews. But the royal support is for the Jewish side of this at this point. And it's legitimizing, again, a state-sponsored Jewish military resistance to any unwarranted aggression that's going to happen. And you have to raise the question, I think, at some point of who on earth is going to be stupid enough to fight the Jews now? If this is the case, who's going to be, the ones that are going to go up against them? But we'll find something of the answer to that, I think, in chapter 9 when we get there. But then this chapter closes out in verses 15 through 17. Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white with a golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many people, many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen on them. Well, a few things here. First of all, you've got this little part of the story that we see from time to time of clothing being significant. Mordecai in sackcloth and ashes, Esther in sackcloth and ashes, Esther putting on royalty, Haman wanting to wear the king's clothes, but instead covering his head in shame and then having his head covered as well. Well, now Mordecai is putting on, again, the clothing of royalty as well. Also, there's a pretty strong contrast here after the first edict was signed. Haman and Ahasuerus sat together in the palace, oblivious to everything that was going on around them, and just, the city's thrown into confusion. Here, by contrast, Mordecai leaves the palace. He goes out to the populace, so to speak, and instead of being thrown into confusion, they celebrate the edict and Mordecai himself as well. And so there's a bunch of reversals. Following the first decree, the Jews mourn. Following this one, they rejoice. Mordecai has exchanged his humiliation and grief for honor and celebration. The people of Susa were perplexed, but now they rejoice. The story begins with a couple of Jews pretending to be Gentiles, or at least one of them pretending to be a Gentile. And now you've got a bunch of Gentiles pretending to be Jews, which I don't think means they're fully converting to Judaism, though some read it that way. I think the idea is they realize who has the upper hand, and so they're joining the ranks of the Jews, so to speak. They're identifying themselves with the Jews in that sense. Or it could mean they're so afraid they're doing Jewish kinds of things. But what would that be in the context of the book of Esther? There's no real clue as to what Judaism looks like in the book of Esther. Those are some interesting things as well. But it's not just reversals. It's going beyond that. You know, Mordecai receives the ring that Haman had worn, but he also receives symbols of royalty that Haman had only dreamed of. Haman wants to wear clothes like this, but Mordecai actually gets to wear them. Members of the court had bowed to Haman because there was a law that's saying they had to, but the whole city acclaims Mordecai. Haman's edict had been sent out by couriers, but Mordecai's edict was sent out by couriers on royal horses bred by the king's own steed. And so it's taken a step further there as well. Haman had built a stake for Mordecai, and that very stake was used for Haman, but not just Haman, but we will find in chapter 9 his 10 sons to be executed on it as well. Haman's private celebration with the king is replaced by the great festivities in this chapter of the whole city, and then the Feast of Purim beyond that as well. The city that was once bewildered by Haman's decree is delighted by Mordecai's. And so things are reversed, but they're not just reversed. They're taken a step beyond that, it seems. And that seems to be a point that the author is making here. All right, we've got a few minutes here for some discussion. If there's any thoughts or questions about anything in chapter 8 that we can talk about a little further. Yeah, Jonathan. Yeah, that I think the question is ultimately going to be, is he saying that to say whatever you write, this is going to be true of? Or is he saying this to say what Haman wrote, this is true of? So, what is the point of reference? Or is it a little bit of both? That might be a way of trying to get himself off the hook here. But some of that would depend on what is his primary focus, I think, there. Dan? Right, and that's, you know, part of the benefit of it having been 3 months at this point is, at this point, you already are beginning to identify who your enemies are, and then by the time a full year is passed, then certainly you would know that. But yeah, it's really less of a true reversal of a decree than a counter decree. That's a good way of putting that. Now, in effect, it's going to reverse it, but as far as the decree itself, it's trying to line by line, point by point, counter the initial and undo it perhaps in some way, or at least offer a countermeasure for it. Yeah, some of that is kind of at least potentially foreshadowed in chapter 6 with the ceremony before that. I would say there is more between him discovering the plot in chapter 2 and the ceremony in chapter 6, and having been written down and the king remembering it and the relationship to Esther. There's more that will naturally lead to Mordecai's promotion than there was for Haman just out of the blue getting the job. I mean, that's the real point that you just don't expect is Mordecai saved the king's life and it was written down in the books, and after these things the king promoted Haman. Right. It's far less abrupt than Haman getting the promotion when he's not even named in the book until suddenly when you expect Mordecai to get something, Haman gets it instead. This is a little bit less abrupt than that. It seems that way to me at least. Yes.
I
think some of it may be the realization that the empire is behind them, and even in the person of Mordecai, it's not just that there is this edict out there, but the prime minister of the nation is one of them, and there is real support for them at this point. The fact that it's tied in with Mordecai's public presentation may be a hint to that. But beyond that, yeah, there's not a whole lot of, it's not that I could see a whole lot of, beyond the edict being written, the royal support being behind them, there's not a whole lot of explanation there. Dan?
Seems like there's a story here for us, too. I mean, if you spiritualize it, or you look for the types in the anti-type, here you have God's people are being delivered. Okay? And so you can try to see,
I think, you know, I've talked fairly extensively over this series about the general, I don't know, buffoonery of King Ahasuerus, and really how that kind of comes to the foreground here, the fact that he is not even remotely concerned with what he needs to be concerned about. He is His temper is abated because his feelings aren't hurt anymore, but he's not solved the problem. He ultimately then solves it by doing the same thing that he had done, exactly the same thing that he had done before, which was the mistake that led to the problem to begin with. He makes terrible, terrible decisions. It's one of those things, you look for foreshadowing in types and anti-types and great spiritual lessons. And one of the things that you find if you do any reading on Esther is there are some people that will make Ahasuerus a counterpart to God. And I always just kind of shudder at that. I think there may be places where there are some lessons that you can draw that way. But even when I think they're legitimate, it still just makes me cringe a little bit to think that this guy can be compared to God in any kind of way. Because God is everything that this king wasn't. This king is foolish in so many ways. This king is weak in so many ways. This king is led by all the wrong kinds of things in so many ways. This king makes stupid laws and agrees to them. He doesn't care about human life. And God is exactly the opposite of all of those things. And God is a king that we can indeed count on and hope in and put our trust in because he does care about us and does want us to live and does want to save us from our enemies and from ourselves. And this is the king that we can indeed glorify. And this is the king that we serve. And he has provided a way of salvation for us. Even today, he has opened the door, he has provided our healing, and he has provided our salvation. But like we said a little while ago, one of the greatest obstacles that we face is trusting in him that he has healed us. Not only trusting him that he can, and trusting him that he will, but trusting him that he has. And we can be the biggest obstacles to ourselves if we will let ourselves be that obstacle. But instead, we must trust him for what he has promised to provide, that he will, that he can, and that he has. And so we take this opportunity, as we do so often, to issue an invitation to anyone who is in need in some way, whether you need to come to God for the first time or to make something right in your life, or if there's just some other way that we can help you. Won't you let it be known as together we stand and sing.